with our microplastics tumbling out of the atmosphere. The equivalent of 300 million plastic bottles fall out of the sky every year as microplastic. We know for sure that it is absolutely everywhere in the environment and in the home. We know that there are lots of toxic things in plastics. We need to reduce our reliance on them. Alternatives are going to help, but we need to be very careful that we are not using things that are just as harmful. The more we produce, the more contaminated the environment becomes.
Welcome to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast, where we meet the world's top experts to explore the secrets of health, mindset, longevity, and so much more. Are you ready to take charge of your existence and biohack your life? This show is for you. Please keep in mind, we're not dispensing medical advice and are not responsible for any outcomes you may experience from implementing the tactics lying herein. Are you ready? Let's do this. Welcome back to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. Oh my goodness, friends, I have been so eager to air today's episode. If you're anything like me, it is going to change your entire perspective on the world. Once you learn all of this information, you just can't unsee it. Matt Simons, A Poison Like None Other, is mind-blowing. You would not believe how prevalent microplastics are in our environment, our nature, our bodies, so many things. It is such a problem. You'll learn where microplastics are, everywhere from Mount Everest to the bottom of the oceans to all in your clothes. We talk about the toxicity potential of plastics, whether or not we will actually evolve to tolerate plastics. That was a cool thing to talk about, as well as some of the greenwashing and myths surrounding things like biodegradables, bioplastics, and recycling. Oh dear, prepare yourself for a whole new perspective. I cannot wait to hear what you guys think. And by the way, after listening, I felt so much better about using my Hold On bags. I asked Matt about Hold On in this episode, and then I did more research afterwards, and I feel so good about them. Listen to the ad in today's show to learn more about them, but they are plant-based bags that can replace your single-use plastics all over your home, which is a major, major problem. I am obsessed with them. I'm using the garbage bags. I really, really love the gallon bags and the liter bags. In particular, Matt talks about the problem of putting plastic in the freezer. Now I'm finally able to easily store my meat, which I often stock up on, in the freezer in non-plastic solutions. I love these bags, and you can get 20% off. Just go to holdonbags.com/Melanie Avalon and use the code Melanie Avalon at checkout for 20% off your order. And again, there will be more details in the ad that runs in today's show, so definitely listen to that. The show notes for today's episode will be at melanieavalon.com/plastic. Those show notes will have a full transcript, so definitely check that out. There will be two episode giveaways for this episode. One will be in my Facebook group, IF Biohackers, Intermittent Fasting plus Real Foods plus Life. Comment something you learned or something that resonated with you on the pinned post to enter to win something that I love. And then check out my Instagram, find the Friday announcement post, and again, comment there to enter to win something that I love. If you're enjoying the show, it would mean the absolute world if you could take a moment and write a brief review on Apple Podcasts. It helps so much more than most people realize, so thank you so much in advance for that. Hey friends, did you know that one of our largest sources of toxic exposure each and every day is through our skincare and makeup? It is so frightening the effects these compounds can have on our health. So we put these products on to help us look better, and yet they actually can be aging us, contributing to health issues, fertility issues, thyroid issues, mood issues, and ready for something potentially even more shocking? A lot of these endocrine disruptors are actually obesogens, meaning they cause your body to gain weight and make it harder to lose weight. That's right, your skincare and makeup may be hindering your weight loss goals. Europe has banned thousands of these compounds, and the US has banned around a dozen. There's even a loophole from the 1960s that allows companies to put whatever they want in their products, and they don't even have to tell you. That's why I am overwhelmingly careful about the skincare and makeup that I use. But here's the thing, it can be hard to find skincare and makeup that is non-toxic and actually works. And then on top of that, that actually has all the products you need. I have found two companies, I am obsessed with their standards and use them every single day of my life and cannot recommend them enough. That's Counter, formerly known as Beauty Counter, and Crunchy. Both of these companies have incredible standards when it comes to what they put in their products. You can truly feel good about using them, and they actually work. For Counter products, go to melanieavalon.com/counter. And for Crunchy products, go to crunchy.com That's CRUNCHI.com/Melanie Avalon. New Crunchy customers can use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 to get 10% off. You'll also receive something special from me after your first order. I also highly recommend joining both of their loyalty programs. It's completely free to join, and with every purchase, you'll earn credit, as well as other fun goodies. For all the latest updates, new products, specials, deals, and fun things for me, because yes, I love giving things away, get on my email list. That's at melanieavalon.com/cleanbeauty. You can also get text updates when you text skincare to 877-861-8318. That's skincare to 877-861-8318. So again, to shop with me and get a free gift from me after your first order, go to melanieavalon.com/counter and also crunchy.com/Melanie Avalon. And new customers use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 at Crunchy to get 10% off site-wide. And again, definitely join their free loyalty programs to earn credit on every order. Hey friends, exciting news. My Avalon X Spirulina is back in stock and now at a reduced price. Plus you get free shipping and my coupon code works on top of that sale price. Spirulina is honestly one of the most nutrient-dense things that you can put in your body in a whole foods, easy to eat form. It's a blue-green algae, which is a complete vegan protein packed with an incredible array of nutrients. We are talking 100% of your daily hard-to-get vitamin K, 625% of vitamin B12, over 1,000% of vitamin A, 86% of chromium, 27% of vitamin B2, plus so much more, including iron, GLA, the powerful antioxidant superoxide dismutase, and even glutathione. In fact, spirulina is so uniquely nutritious that it was actually studied by NASA to support the astronauts. I searched high and low to find the very best spirulina out there. Ours comes from a wonderful, sustainable, clean, environmentally friendly production facility in Hawaii. Not Thailand, Hawaii. And then on top of that, we did our own third-party testing for over 70 pesticides, heavy metals, toxins, all the things. This is the cleanest spirulina out there. And with spirulina, you can simplify your supplement routine and support your nutrition in one easy step. The tablets are super versatile. You can swallow them whole, blend them into smoothies, crush them up, or honestly, just eat them like I do. And again, we were out of stock, but now Avalon X Spirulina is finally back in stock at a reduced price, and my coupon code MelanieAvalon works on top of that too. Plus, you get free shipping. Just go to avalonx.us/spirulina and use the coupon code MelanieAvalon to get 10% off our new reduced price plus free shipping. That's avalonx.us/spirulina with the coupon code MelanieAvalon. All right, without further ado, please enjoy this wonderful conversation with Matt Simon. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the show. I am so incredibly excited about the conversation that I am about to have. So, backstory on today's conversation, it's sort of the definition of small world. I was introduced to today's guest through another podcast guest that I've had on the show, John Levy, who I really recommend his book and his work. He's amazing. And he does something called the Influencers Dinner, where he invites really cool people to meet each other. And he basically knows anybody and everybody. And he always throws the most incredible guests my way. So he introduced me to Matt Simon, who is a science journalist at Wired Magazine, who has a few books, including a new book that we're going to talk about on this show. But it was such a small world because it turns out that Matt sits, well, when he is in the office, like we were talking about, but when he's in the office, he sits right next to one of my best friends from college, which is just crazy. So that was an exciting moment. But in any case, his newest book is called A Poison Like No Other: How Microplastics Corrupted Our Planet and Our Bodies. Friends, if you read this book, or maybe I guess after listening to this interview, I will just say that this book has completely changed my perception of the world. And I mean that, like, literally. I see things differently than I did before. I knew the plastic issues was a problem. I was trying to help the situation by doing things like buying BPA-free, which I'm sure we're going to talk about, or really cleaning up my skincare and makeup and getting rid of phthalates and things like that. But I don't think I was really thinking about it, and I didn't understand the entire implications, and I definitely didn't understand what actually feasibly needs to happen or what can be done. So I'm really excited about this conversation. I think it's going to open a lot of people's eyes. I have a lot of questions. Matt, thank you so much for being here.
And thank you for having me.
I have to just tell you really quickly, I think one of the saddest moments reading your book for me was when I realized that one of my favorite things in life, which is glitter, is like just plastic. Like I'm just throwing plastic everywhere.
It's the ultimate microplastic. It is. Yeah, it's fun. I don't want to detract from the entertainment of glitter, but it is plastic and it is particularly good at getting into all sorts of nooks and crannies. And I think it's actually quite a good representation of the problem of microplastics at large, as this stuff can get absolutely everywhere, as glitter can in your home if it's escaping from a greeting card or something like that.
Actually, it's a really good metaphor too, because it seems so wonderful and happy and does so many great things for us, but a little bit sinister. Okay, so before we get into all of this, I am super curious. Did somebody bring this idea to you? Were you already interested in this? Are you an environmentalist? Like, what's your backstory? Well, in general, because you also have two other books, right, that we were just talking about before this. You have The Wasp That Brainwashed the Caterpillar, Evolution's Most Unbelievable Solutions to Life's Biggest Problems, and also Plight of the Living Dead, What Real-Life Zombies Reveal About Our World and Ourselves, which is about parasites mind-controlling their hosts. So I really want to read both of these books. What made you so interested in everything that you're doing and ultimately to write this book about plastics?
Sure. So I have been writing at Wired for a dozen years now, and I have been generally interested in, obviously, science, being a science journalist. So my previous two books, as you mentioned, were more about biology, animals basically doing weird things to each other, and the weird inventions that evolution has come up with to fix life's problems. But in recent years, I have been reporting more and more on microplastic pollution, which is a very new science, actually. So it really has been in the past couple of years that we've gotten a lot more studies on the extent of microplastic pollution. So in recent years, there have been, you know, quantifications of how much of it's in the atmosphere, for example. There was a paper that came out and got quite a bit of press, including from us, a couple of years ago, finding a lot of microplastics in baby poop, which is terrifying. And we know exactly how that's getting into babies, and it's scary in and of itself. But as these studies have been trickling out, I had been reporting on them for Wired and realized that nobody had really done kind of a cohesive treatment of the state of microplastic science, which is what I set out to do here. So I read through lots and lots of papers, spoke to over 100 microplastic scientists for the book, and then kind of gathered up the state of the science, what we know about microplastics, what we don't know. We know for sure that it is absolutely everywhere in the environment and in the home. The next frontier is the consequences. What does that mean for ecosystems and for human health in particular?
Two questions right off the bat about that. One, so because you said you've been writing about it at Wired for a while, was there a moment where you like read some headline study and got interested, or was it just a slow, like, was there an inciting incident that made you interested?
I think the same with how a lot of people come into microplastics is that you hear about it and you think, oh, that doesn't sound particularly good. Plastics that are micro, that could be problematic. I had been, you know, there wasn't really a defining moment for me. I had just started realizing it during the pandemic. Actually, I was sitting around with not a lot to do during lockdown. I thought, here's a great idea to make myself feel worse about the state of the world. Why don't I do a book-length treatment of the state of microplastic science? So there wasn't really a defining moment. It was a sort of slow realization that this is a massive problem and a really exploding field in science, because you can talk to a lot of microplastics researchers who will tell you that I did not set out to do this. I was a biologist, or I was a geologist, and I was finding all this stuff out in the environment and started wondering about the implications. And that's how I got into being a microplastics researcher. It's drawing in so many people from all these different disciplines because the stuff is everywhere in the environment. Everywhere scientists look, I'm not exaggerating when I say absolutely everywhere. That has drawn in just a wide swath of people across the scientific spectrum to create, I think, this really interesting and burgeoning field.
Yeah, that really blew my mind, the part about the extreme environments even that it's in, and that there's even microplastics on the top of Mount Everest, which is just mind-blowing. You provide so many stats in the book about the prevalence and the amount of these in the environment. So I'd love to hear what some of those are. But in addition to that, how do scientists quantify that? Like, how do we know like how many tons of these there are in the oceans and different areas?
It's a great question. And it's because it's a burgeoning field, they're actually still standardizing the methodology for both collecting microplastics in the environment and for analyzing them in the lab. So you can go to, say, the Pacific Ocean, and two scientific teams can pull up, you know, basically the same liter of water, but they will oftentimes put it through different filters of different fineness. So if your net is finer, you can actually count more microplastics as you're getting some of the smaller stuff. So that makes it a little bit difficult in these early days of the field to compare quantifications of microplastics in a given medium. But those methodologies are coalescing. And what we're finding is increasing agreement among studies about the total saturation of microplastics in the environment. So I think a good one to talk about, and you mentioned microplastics getting up to Mount Everest, that isn't necessarily, and this might be a contribution, isn't necessarily that people are walking around up there shedding microfibers from their synthetic clothing, which is made out of plastic. It is more because this stuff is all over the atmosphere. So there was one quantification a year or two ago, and I actually visited this scientist in the book and talk about it in the introduction. She has these instruments on top of remote mountains in the Western United States, and she collects what's falling out of the sky. We're calling it plastic rain, essentially. There are microplastics tumbling out of the atmosphere. And by collecting them in these catchers out on these remote mountaintops, she calculated that in just 6% of the United States, in these Western protected areas, the equivalent of 300 million plastic bottles fall out of the sky every year as microplastic. So to scale that up much bigger across the United States, we're talking about the equivalent of billions of plastic bottles falling out of the sky as a microplastic each year. That's how much of the stuff is up in the atmosphere. And because it's up there, it can then swirl around the entire planet. It is falling on remote rainforests in South America. It's falling in Antarctica. It's also in the oceans. It's swirling around there. Scientists have been showing recently that it actually can blow out of the ocean and come on shore in sea breezes. The extent of the problem has not really been realized until recently. But because we have more of these studies, now we're seeing, wow, we are dealing with a just near total contamination of the environment with microplastics. And we haven't even talked about nanoplastics yet. So microplastics are defined as bits smaller than 5 millimeters. Nanoplastics are much, much smaller. They're smaller than a micrometer, which is a millionth of a meter. There are way more of those in the environment than there are microplastics, but it's still very difficult and expensive to detect nanoplastics. So I try to drive this home point in the book as often as I can, is that whenever you hear a quantification of microplastics in the environment, it's almost certainly a significant undercount because there are just a lot more of these nanoplastics out there than they are microplastics. Something to keep in mind going forward as people maybe get interested in microplastics is just basically consider the worst, unfortunately, because there are limits to what scientists can actually detect in the environment.
So the microplastics being 5 millimeters, so you can see that, right? You can see some of them.
Yeah, I think a good way to think of it, less than 5 millimeters is about the width of a pencil eraser. So that's obviously visible with the human eye. So you can actually, in the home, one of the major contributions to microplastic contamination is microfibers from things like polyester and nylon. We wear a lot of that stuff, obviously, and that breaks off and flies around indoor air. So if you look through a window, through sunshine coming through a window, you can actually see these things floating in the air. So, but then they get much smaller, anywhere between 5 millimeters down to micrometers, millionths of a meter. This is a whole spectrum. And like a piece of plastic can be 5.1 millimeters. It's basically a microplastics, but because we have to to standardize what a microplastic is. It's not technically considered a microplastic. It's a bit of a gray area. But yes, you can see them with the naked eye, but a lot of them we really can't. And those are significantly higher quantities in the environment.
Can we actually step back? Because you tell the history of plastics in the book and the really interesting relation to billiard balls. So what's the history of the formation of plastics? Why do we have them now?
It's a interesting and tragic story. So you have mentioned billiard balls. This began in the late 1800s when people were playing more and more billiards. Those balls were made out of ivory from elephants. So that was obviously a finite resource. And this very famous billiards player put out a call for submissions for people to think up, to invent a synthetic alternative to ivory to make billiard balls out of. And that was what led to the first mass producible plastic toward the end of the 1800s. Because of that, that's just this one guy had this idea in his head. That first plastic just proliferated into a just insane number of different plastics over the following decades. And it really was in World War II where people started replacing more natural fibers, for instance, like cotton with nylon, because there were supply shortages. And that then started increasing exponentially after World War II, the production of that. And we have had since then, almost a century now, an increasing exponential production of plastics. And as that happens in the environment, scientists can look back and, you know, sediment samples back to the 1940s and 50s and beyond, and I can actually plot the increasing concentration of microplastic in the environment in lockstep with that exponential increase in plastic production. So the more we produce, the more contaminated the environment becomes, which I do not think this billiards player had in mind when he put out that call for submissions.
I have so many questions about that. Yeah, one is that, I mean, I mentioned this even with the glitter. I did not realize, I can't emphasize this enough, how much I didn't realize what all is plastic. Like, I think I had such a finite view of what plastic was. Like, I would have come in my apartment. If you were like, point at the plastic, I would have like pointed at certain specific things. Like, I didn't realize it's almost in everything, it seems. Like, clothing is 2/3, I think you said. 2/3 of clothing is plastic, of conventional clothing.
Yep. 2/3, which I don't think very many people actually realize. You go buy a shirt having no idea that polyester or nylon, that's a plastic. It's a very soft plastic, but it has a lot of these really great properties, admittedly. It can waterproof. And fleece, for instance, is super warm. Everybody loves fleece. That's made out of synthetic fibers, though. The issue is that while 2/3 of clothing is now made out of synthetic fibers, we have a lot of natural fibers, like what we think is a pure cotton or pure wool garment, is actually now coated in plastic polymers to make it like fireproof or waterproof. These sneaky ways that plastics have really infiltrated every aspect of our lives. And when you think about carpeting in the home, obviously made out of synthetic fibers, but also hardwood flooring. So if you have vinyl flooring or laminate or something like that, that's made out of plastic. There has been at least one study that has showed that in homes with that hardwood, you do get little bits breaking off and entering the indoor air. So all around us, beyond the, you know, the bags and the bottles, the obvious plastics, there are these sneaky ways that plastics have gotten to every aspect of our lives.
Like, I didn't even realize, because I talk about phthalates all the time because I'm very passionate about safe skincare and makeup. And phthalates are plastic, right? Or partly?
Phthalates are a major component of plastic. So phthalates are a broad group of chemicals that help make plastic plastic. So at the very base of it, a plastic is just repeating chains of carbon. So fossil fuel companies will extract that carbon, obviously from the environment, from the ground. Natural gas and oil becomes plastic. That's the base layer of those carbon chains. But to make a plastic, to make it lighter, to make it tougher, to make it melt-proof, that sort of thing, they have to add all sorts of additional chemicals, phthalates included. The issue is that these plastics companies do not tell us what is in these plastics. There's no ingredient list for a plastic bottle. So what chemists actually have to do is reverse engineer these plastics in the lab. And they have found that there have been at least 10,500 chemicals used in plastics. A quarter of those chemicals are considered to be of concern, meaning they're either known to be toxic or they're persistent in the environment. So phthalates is one of these major groups that is a thing very specific to plastic. And there was a study that came out a couple of years ago, and we're going to see actually more of these kinds of studies going forward, that is linking phthalates to human health problems. So they calculated by looking at phthalate levels in the blood of people that on a very conservative estimate, phthalates are responsible for 100,000 premature deaths in the United States each year. Phthalates are coming from plastics. That's the source of it. And I think in the next couple of years, maybe 5 years or so, we're going to see more of these studies that are linking plastics to human health problems. And now we have to consider, okay, where is that coming from? Is that because we're drinking from plastic bottles? Is that because our food is wrapped in plastic? Or is there also a contribution from microplastics? Because we are inhaling little tiny bits of plastic, and are these chemicals getting into our bloodstream that way? So phthalates are just one of a number of endocrine disrupting chemicals, which I'm sure you've touched on before. These are really terrible chemicals that make our hormone system go haywire. So we will see, I think, again, going forward in the next couple of years, more of these studies coming out. This is the urgency, I think, is that we don't need to wait for that. We know that there are lots of toxic things in plastics. We need to reduce our reliance on them, reduce our exposure, because we know for sure a lot of these chemicals are terrible for human health.
You're talking about how there's no overview or regulation and we don't know what's actually in these different plastics. How does that compare to other industries? Is that the way it is with all industries of like textile materials and different materials, or just plastics where there's not regulation?
Yeah, unfortunately, in the United States, we just don't have a very robust framework for testing of chemicals before they enter the market. You're actually seeing much more movement on this in the European Union. They're much stricter about what chemicals can get banned. But the billiards player who put out the call for an alternative to elephant ivory in billiards never assumed that we would eventually be inhaling little bits of plastic years down the line. Car tires are another major one. Car tires are made out of synthetic rubber. That's a synthetic plastic. Little bits break off and into the environment. We inhale them when we're walking down the road because they're getting kicked up into the air. Tire manufacturers, I don't think, ever assumed that we would be ingesting their tires. That is not food safe plastic. So there isn't really this regulatory framework that we need to phase out these specific chemicals that we know to be terrible. Because, you know, you again, 10,000 different chemicals in plastics, at least, which one is going to be bad for human health? It's probably going to be a bunch of them at the same time. But then we have to think about, well, what about every other organism on this planet that is now exposed to microplastics because this stuff is so pervasive in the environment? What might be okay for the human body might not be for some small crustacean that's part of a very important food web in the ocean. So this is why there's a lot of problems also with thinking about alternatives to plastic, is that we need to test the toxicity of these things against all sorts of different organisms, because this stuff is going to get out in the environment, it's going to break into little tiny pieces. That's the challenge here. It's very daunting, and I don't imagine that's a very hopeful answer for you all, but this is why we need to pressure governments to be stronger in their regulation of plastics, as we're realizing more and more that plastic is just, it's toxic, it's terrible, and we need to figure out to what extent it is impacting human health. But the early studies are pretty alarming, I think.
You talk in the book about how, in addition to the actual potential toxicity of the plastic itself, other pollutants can come with it, or heavy metals or things in the atmosphere, and it can usher that in as well. So, I mean, it just seems like such a problem. So you talk about how, I think you said urban environments are actually, well, how does it compare rural versus urban? I thought it was a little bit counterintuitive, the concentrations, because you talked about like things being trapped by buildings and there was more plastics maybe in rural areas.
It is counterintuitive. Yeah. I think it's actually rather fascinating in kind of a morbid way, really. So when we're talking about urban areas in dense cities, we have a lot of microplastic production from roads, right? So cars are driving around lots in cities. Brake pads are wearing off as cars are in bumper-to-bumper traffic. But atmospheric modeling is actually showing that cities tend to hold on to a lot of those microplastics because there's not a lot of wind being able to whip through a downtown area, for example, compared to a rural environment. If you have a road that's exposed, there are a lot more winds coming in and taking up those tire microplastics in particular into the atmosphere. This is a good time, I think, to talk about sludge, which is a not particularly nice term for a very gross product. So when we do laundry, we wash our synthetic clothing, these little fibers break off, perhaps millions of them in a single load of laundry and flow out to a wastewater treatment facility where that water is treated. And those microfibers actually mix with human waste and are sequestered into something called sludge. And this is human waste that is then taken and spread on fields as fertilizer. So we are actually seeing that about 90% of the microplastics that flow to a wastewater treatment facility are sequestered in sludge and then spread on fields. There was one calculation that it's something like 1 billion pounds of microplastics spread in Europe each year on fields just from our clothing. The remaining 10% at the wastewater treatment facility is pumped out to sea in the relatively clean water. And that is a big reason why the seas are quite contaminated with microplastics. So when we are thinking about rural areas, people in cities with higher population densities are sending their sludge to these fields to be spread as fertilizer. That is applying a concentrated microplastic to fields. And there is some evidence showing that it's being taken up into crops through the roots. These particles are quite small and are capable of doing that. But then in these rural areas, you get these high winds. If a field dries out and those microplastics take to the sky, they can actually be propelled quite high into the atmosphere and then carried perhaps thousands of miles. And in addition, when you are thinking about rural highways, roads, that sort of thing, cars are driving much faster than they are in a city center. So if you're going 70, 75 miles an hour, you're providing much more energy to fire those tire microplastics into the atmosphere. And that's why cities tend to hold on to, presumably, like this is what the modeling is showing, tend to hold on to more of their microplastics, whereas it's just coming off of the landscape in these rural areas and taking to the sky, in addition to the stuff that is falling back out of the atmosphere, as that researcher I mentioned has been calculating in Western areas. So there's this extremely complicated microplastic cycle that's now coming into view, how it's moving between these different mediums, between the land and the air and the ocean. It is doing so quite readily. And that's why everything is so contaminated, is because these things are tiny, they're light, they very easily take to the air, and nowhere is untouched. You'll ask any microplastic scientist, is there anywhere that's clean? They say no, everywhere. Absolutely, everywhere is contaminated.
Hey, friends, I'm about to tell you how to get 10% off the ideal coffee when it comes to supporting your health. So if you guys know me, you know I am obsessed with optimizing basically everything I consume, and that especially relates to coffee. Did you know that coffee is one of the most powerful sources of antioxidants in the modern diet? And yet, not all coffee is created equal. Between sourcing, farming practices, roasting, and contaminants, there can be a huge difference in the health impact of the coffee that you drink. That is exactly why I created Glow Coffee. Glow Coffee is a premium, specialty-grade Arabica coffee sourced from sustainable women-led farms in Colombia. It's organically grown, and we third-party test it meticulously, like every single lot, for purity. And what makes Glow especially exciting from a biohacking perspective is that we specifically made it to be rich in chlorogenic acid, or CGA. That's one of coffee's primary, most potent antioxidant compounds that has been studied for its role in metabolic health, inflammation, oxidative stress, and so much more. The elevation levels of the beans, how they're grown, and how they're roasted all affect CGA levels. So we searched high and low to find the perfect beans naturally high in CGA and tested them to confirm that, And then we roast those beans to preserve the CGA content. And then test after that as well. Coffee is already one of the potentially biggest contributors of antioxidants in the human diet, so I designed Glow Coffee to maximize those benefits while keeping it incredibly clean and high quality. And this coffee is so clean. It's grown organically, of course, but then we go even farther than that. We third-party test the beans for almost 100 toxic compounds, including pesticides, heavy metals, and mold. Oh, and perhaps the best part is it is absolutely delicious. We're talking smooth, low bitterness. It's honestly the exact coffee I personally want to drink every single day of my life. It's so bright, smooth, and delicious that it's also perfect black for fasting. No added sweeteners or cream needed. You can also splash it on your face for an antioxidant-rich toner. I do that every single day. After the sauna, after the shower, all the things. I created Glow Coffee because it's really about upgrading one of our most common daily habits into something that truly supports your health and performance. You can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. That's 10% off Glow Coffee with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. Are you ready to glow inside and out? Fuel your day, illuminate your way. That's glowcoffeeco.com.
That is so, so crazy.
Sorry. Yeah, I wish I had better news for you.
No, I know. I know. Oh, it's funny. I sent, because my assistant helps me with prep for the show. And so she was reading my notes and she was, I don't remember exactly what she said, but her comment was just like, well, like, oh no, I don't know how I feel now. So I thought that was so interesting though. So the plastics actually work as a fertilizer. They actually help the plants grow.
It's an unintentional byproduct of sludge. So what's helping the plants grow is weird to think about, but it's our human waste. It's used as fertilizer from our urine and feces. That's spread on, it's disinfected as best they can first and then spread on fields that way. Microplastics are just accidentally in there, but there's not very much research on what that actually means for crops, but also soils. There have been a few studies that have showed that the more that you increase the concentration of microplastics in soils, the more you change the property. So sometimes it actually absorbs less water or lets go of more water to evaporate away, which could have implications for growing crops. It also harms all sorts of critters in the soil. There's good research showing that when earthworms ingest microplastics, they eat less regular food, their mortality is higher, their reproduction goes down. This is coming back to this idea that there are at least 10,000 different chemicals that have been used in plastics. Any one of those can be harmful to an earthworm, probably several at the same time. We just need more research on, oh my God, if every organism is corrupted in its own ways and ingesting these things, what's going to be harmful for one but not another?
I did not realize that that's how conventional agriculture fertilized stuff. I just didn't know that.
Yeah, it's gross. It's gross and it's weird and it's very widespread. And it's 1 billion pounds of microplastics applied to fields in Europe each year. It's a little bit less in North America, in the United States and Canada, just because we have a little bit less agriculture here than they do across the entire European Union. But it is... wow, it's a lot. It's close to 1 billion pounds here. It's hard to fathom. And this is also accumulating in those soils. There have been a couple of experiments that have actually looked back for many, many years and have shown that the more microplastics applied to a soil in a given year, the more that stick around in that soil. So it's gathering, it's accumulating year after year, and that could have detrimental effects on our crops going forward.
Before leaving the urban and the cars and all of that stuff, so you do talk about the implications of things like, so solutions like magnets under cars that gather plastics or electric cars, both of those options, what would happen there?
Yeah, it's a neat little piece of technology still in development. There's a group called the Tire Collective that is developing the sort of attachment that goes behind a car tire and uses basically the static electricity that's generated from the friction of the tire to gather up microplastics as they're flying off of that synthetic rubber before the stuff has a chance to hit the road, which is neat. It would require getting these on lots and lots of cars, because this is like every car and truck on the road is spewing microplastics, lots and lots of them year over year. There are other farther downstream things that we could do for roads. So I'm a huge proponent of something called a rain garden. This is a little green space you might have seen in a city next to a road where there's some plants growing, perhaps. This is predominantly used to gather rainwater and reduce flooding in an urban area. But there was a study that showed that this actually has the added benefit of capturing over 90% of microplastics in rainwater coming off of roads. So these have multiple benefits. You green up an urban area, you reduce flooding, and at the same time, you kind of capture these microplastics before they're able to flow out to a body of water. So there are these small solutions that we, I think, can add up to something quite substantial to reduce the amount of microplastics going into the environment. But there are just so many ways for this stuff to get out there that it is going to be very difficult to turn down the tap of microplastics flowing into the environment.
Speaking to that timeline and just the actual reality of everything. So, because we're talking about gathering up these plastics, we haven't even talked about recycling yet. I guess what I'm trying to ask is, so if we stopped right now and we didn't create any more plastic, is the plastic just here indefinitely? Like, is the only option to recycle it into new plastic, or can we actually get rid of any of it? Is that even a possibility? Can we launch it into space?
Good fire into the sun, yeah. Unfortunately, the microplastic that's out in the environment is out there forever. There's just no way for us to drag some sort of magnet through the ocean to collect the microplastics there. It's impossible. It will, I think, settle in ocean sediments, but I think for a very long time, even if we stopped producing plastic, even if somehow we kept our clothes from shedding fibers that flow out to the ocean or put onto fields as sludge, this stuff will be circulating in the atmosphere for quite some time. And this is not even considering the fact that any macroplastics, so macroplastic being a big thing like a bottle or a bag, that's really just pre-microplastic. So as it's in the environment, it's breaking into smaller and smaller bits. So all the big stuff that's out there as well is going to break into microplastics over time. And we just have such a unmitigated flow of both macro and microplastics into the environment that it's going to be very difficult to stop. In a perfect world, if we somehow did, if we stopped using plastics entirely, yes, the concentrations, I think, would go down in the environment as it was sequestered in sediments and things like that. I don't know how long that would take. This is, I think, the ultimate urgency, is that we are up against a plastics industry that will happily triple production by 2050. That's the projection here. And that will triple the amount of microplastic going into the environment. We do not have time to get to that. That's an insane thing to think about. We're producing a trillion pounds of plastic a year, which is a wildly high number for any sort of material, especially plastic, when you consider that plastic is very light. Think about how much plastic would make up a trillion pounds. That is current levels in 2022. That will triple by 2050 unless we get something like a plastics treaty, which is in negotiations as we speak, to severely curtail the production of plastic. That's the only thing that's going to stop this problem. The industry will scream from the rooftops for the rest of its days that we just need to recycle more. That was never going to work. Unfortunately, there's a bunch of problems with recycling. That's not going to save us here. Microplastics scientists will tell you across the board, the only way to stop this is to stop producing so much plastic.
So the efforts that are in place, like this discussion that you're talking about to curtail plastics, how are plastics framed? Is the main issue the effect on humans or the effect on the environment?
It's everything. And this is, I think, why I have a good amount of hope for something like a plastics treaty and just kind of generally the momentum that is behind this drive to use less plastic. So it is both microplastics researchers saying, hey, folks, this is absolutely everywhere in the environment. We are already finding effects on organisms. So for instance, in Washington state, in recent decades, there have been mass die-offs of salmon in rivers up there. And scientists had no idea why until a couple of years ago, when they isolated a particular chemical from tire particles, these microplastics coming off of cars, that kills these salmon en masse. So we have that one, like, that's one species that we have documented harm with. There have been additional follow-up studies that found two more species of fish are susceptible to this chemical. So it's probably killing much more fish than we already realize. But in these, I think, more subtle ways, and like in the open ocean, you have these little organisms called plankton that are the very base of the oceanic food web. They're just the right size to eat these things, to mistake microplastics for actual food. And they're filling up their stomachs with this obviously indigestible material that is both leaching chemicals into its body, but also obstructing its digestive system. And there's good research showing that this is actually decreasing their appetite for actual food, which could have massive implications running up and down the food web. So when I mentioned earlier that this field is growing rapidly because so many different scientists from other fields are actually being drawn into it, it's because nowhere on the planet is untouched. And these are the consequences that I think are driving a lot of the recent movement to put severe curtailments on the production of plastic. That is, again, the only way that we're going to stop this crisis. And we haven't as much talked yet about the human health aspects here. It's that's the like we also have people who work with EDCs, these endocrine disrupting chemicals, saying this is bad. We cannot be surrounding our stuff. We cannot be surrounding ourselves with this material because it is packed with chemicals we know to be really terrible for human health, even in very small doses, perhaps like you would get by inhaling microplastics. So I think the movement is broad. It's gaining momentum for something like a plastics treaty, but we're up against petrochemical companies, which are the most powerful and rich corporations on the planet, who have a legal obligation to their shareholders to maximize their profits, which means producing more and more plastics. So they are essentially legally obligated to destroy this planet. That's criminal. It's absurd. And it is something that is going to take a lot of ground swelling. So from individual consumers, maybe donating time or money to anti-plastics groups, the only way we're going to see movement on this, in the United States at least, is to wrench our politicians away from the influence of these petrochemical companies. They are very much funded by groups like Exxon and any number of petrochemical companies. Our government is captured by oil, gas and oil interests. And these are the same people that are going to switch as we decarbonize our economy from producing fossil fuels as fuels to producing more fossil fuels to go into plastics. That's the sneaky thing that they're already doing here, is they see the writing on the wall. We're going to switch to green technologies. We cannot let it be that they switch to producing more plastics, because that comes with its own climate implications. There was one calculation that by 2050, the growth in the plastics industry could mean that we're adding 600 coal-fired power plants worth of emissions to the atmosphere, because these are, again, fossil fuels. So we are going to see movement on the human health side, I think, but also from the climate side. Climate scientists are also very interested in the contribution of plastics to the problem. And I think once we realize as a society that we cannot let the petrochemical industry bamboozle us again into thinking that something like plastic is easily recyclable, it's our fault as consumers that the environment has become so saturated with plastics. We cannot let that happen again with microplastics. This is not a problem of you wearing yoga pants or a nice weatherproof jacket that's made out of plastic. That is not your fault, because not a lot of people realize that was plastic. This is on the industry. And that's who we need to hold accountable for this.
When do we start realizing that this was an issue?
This is kind of the tragic thing, I think, about it. So one of the first papers on microplastics came out in the early 70s. And I talked to this researcher who's still doing science here in 2022. I talked to him for the book, and he described to me what it was like as an oceanographer. So he found nurdles on the open ocean. So nurdles are these little pellets. They're about the size of lentils. These are the raw materials that are melted down into plastic bottles and bags, that sort of thing. They are shipped all over the world and lost along those supply chains in incredible numbers. They leak very easily into the environment. So he was out in the open ocean pulling up nets full of plankton, supposed to be just animals and finding these little pellets way off of the eastern coast of the United States. So he wrote up those findings and published it in the journal Science, this big prestigious journal. And we talk about this in the book. He says that he was visited by somebody from the plastics industry who did not take too kindly to this research. He did a follow-up study a couple of years later that found them, these nurdles, in fish, closer in fish stomach, closer to the East Coast. He told me that it was basically like if you and I had swallowed a bowling ball. That's the obstruction that this is creating in those organisms. So after that, unfortunately, there were just kind of a smattering of studies here and there, but the focus really shifted to macroplastics. So keeping bottles and bags from getting into the environment, which is all well and good. We should most certainly be doing that. But as those decades went on, the microplastics problem got worse and worse. And very few people were actually noticing until, like, the word microplastic, the term, the scientific definition wasn't termed until 2004. That is a long time. That is, you know, 30 years that we were not fully realizing the extent of microplastic pollution in the environment. But since 2004, almost 20 years now, we have been getting much more studies as, again, a lot of people from different fields are kind of just tumbling into microplastic science by accident. So the body of evidence is growing. Again, we've got a good grasp on where it is in the environment and what concentrations. Now more of the focus is turning to the consequences for all those organisms out there, plants and animals, but also for humans who are exposed to a lot of microplastic in the home in particular.
Speaking to the effect on the species and, like you said, how it's like us swallowing a bowling ball, have you seen or have any species had any evolutionary adaptions to plastic, or could they in theory? Or is it a poison like no other, like there's no adaption?
It's actually a fantastic question and something that I was thinking about while writing the book, but did not put anything in there about it. This is something that the scientists are thinking about. So if, you know, let's take a crustacean, like a little tiny crustacean, plankton floating around on the open ocean. It's like 5 millimeters long, which is about the size, you know, the upper limit of what a microplastic can be. It ingests that microplastic. Let's talk very theoretically here. So very theoretically, you could have an organism that ingests that fine. Like maybe it has some sort of genetic mutation that allows it to power through, you know, a particular chemical in that plastic that would poison one of its peers. And then it survives and it passes down those genes that adapt it to ingesting microplastics. Is that theoretically possible? Maybe. I don't know. It was something I was thinking about or writing the book, and it's something that scientists are thinking about. What we have actually been seeing is on the microorganism scale. So you had mentioned earlier that, you know, we are finding that these plastics accumulate things in the environment. This is actually something called the plastosphere. These are very fascinating communities of microorganisms that actually gather on these little tiny particles of plastic. You can get a scanning electron microscope, which does these beautiful, very close-up pictures of these communities, and it's bustling. There's all kinds of things on this plastic, and they are finding that some of these appear to be bacteria that are kind of digging holes into the surface of the plastic. They might be in some way digesting the plastic. Maybe that helps this certain kind of bacteria, but it's not a good thing. I just want to be clear that we cannot rely on this bacteria to clear microplastics out of the environment. And this is something I get angry about. You hear, I get pitched a lot as a science journalist about these alternatives that, we found this microorganism or this enzyme that can digest plastic. Well, what are you going to do? Release it in massive quantities into the environment and screw up all sorts of microbial communities? No. But it's a great question. It's a very interesting idea that because every organism essentially is exposed to microplastic, might there be some of them that develop resistance to the poisons within those plastics?
Hi, friends. Would you like to have the most epic eating experience? I'm talking eradicate bloating and better absorb your nutrients. If so, you need digestive enzymes. These are one of my most favorite supplements out of everything I take, and I truly cannot imagine my life without them. Digestive enzymes are key to break down your food into usable nutrition, and to stop things like bloating, digestive distress, constipation, all the things. That's why I created Avalon X Digest, and you can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at avalonx.us. You can also get a subscription and save 15%, which you can pause or cancel at any time. Friends, I worked so hard to create the perfect blend of enzymes for Avalon X Digest. It's a full-spectrum, plant-based enzyme blend with proteases to help you break down protein, amylase for carbs, lipase for fats, cellulase for fiber, and so much more. In fact, there are 13 different types of enzymes in this blend. I cannot tell you how many people have told me that when they take Avalon X Digest, they experience no digestive distress with meals. These are truly game changers. And for any of you guys looking to up your protein intake, Avalon X Digest will help you actually break down and assimilate your protein so you get more protein from your meals. I wanted to create the highest potency enzymes so that you get all of these benefits when you eat with no problematic fillers or ingredients. Avalon X Digest is also tested multiple times for purity and potency, comes in glass bottles, and is truly the best enzymes on the market. And again, you can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at avalonx.us.
It's so interesting because you could almost, I mean, if you just want to just brainstorm and think about crazy ideas, I mean, you could imagine a situation where looking at millions of years, assuming we're still here, there's some other species that evolves to adapt to all of these environmental pollutants. And so, you know, and then humans don't. And so like humans get wiped out and this other species actually evolves. And like in millions of years, there's a different, like it looks completely different.
Yeah. Plastic resistant in some sort of species. I think one of the truly embarrassing and devastating things about microplastic pollution is that it's going to be an artifact. It's in the fossil record. So as I had mentioned, scientists can go into the sediments of in the ocean and dig down through these layers and go back to the 1940s and chart over time the exponential increase in the amount of microplastics over the decades. So, you know, our descendants, say 500 years, if we make it that long down the line, will go back through the fossil record and find this truly astonishing and embarrassing signal of microplastics infesting the fossil record. There should be organisms in there. Now it's synthetic particles of plastic. That's what I find upsetting is the record that we're leaving for those that come after us is ugly. And it's devastating, I think.
One of the things that bothers me is stuff like, there's so much unnecessary plastic, in my opinion. Like I eat a lot of cucumbers, like a lot, and I buy them in bulk at Costco. And there's so much plastic wrapped around them, you know, like in the actual cucumbers. And then there's like the plastic layer around that. I was always just concerned historically before reading your book about the plastic touching the cucumber and then somehow leaching into the cucumber and having that effect. But now it seems like it could be so much more than that. So actually, first, really quick question. So like when plastics touch food, like because there's lots of like wrapped produce and stuff like that, and even meats at the grocery store, does that leach into the food touching? Like, so can plastic just by touching leach into things?
Yes. And this is a good opportunity to talk about what we shouldn't do with food plastics. So under no circumstances should you microwave plastic or freeze it. That's also terrible. That breaks apart these plastics. So in general, the things that tend to break down.
Plastic freezer bags, like that you put in the freezer.
Don't do it. The things that tend to break down plastics are UV light, for one, in the environment. So that's why a bottle or bag will over time break down because the UV light bombards it and breaks apart the bonds within the plastic. And then it just splits into smaller pieces. Heating and freezing. Plastics are very tough by design, but heating and freezing, these temperature changes do the same thing. They break the plastic apart. And when that happens, it actually allows these bonds to come apart and leach out different chemicals in plastic. So when I mentioned that study that linked phthalates in plastics to 100,000 early deaths in the United States each year on a very conservative estimate, that might be from foods wrapped in plastic, or it might be from microplastics. There's no way of knowing at the moment that the study didn't look at that, but it might be a little bit of both. So you mentioned cucumbers. I lose my goddamn mind anytime I'm in a supermarket and I see a cucumber wrapped in single-use plastic. It's like, are we not aware that cucumbers have their own skins that work perfectly fine? And this is a talking point in the plastics industry, is that plastics are so useful because they keep our food fresher longer, and that means there's less plastic. And that means there's less food waste in the United States, which is, I think the numbers on actual food waste in the United States would say otherwise. That also doesn't take into account the fact that in the United States, we recycle about 5% of plastic, which is crazy. Historically, about 10% of plastics ever produced have been recycled. The rest have been thrown into landfills or burned or just chucked into the environment. So when we produce this plastic, we don't recycle it in the United States. We actually ship it across oceans to developing countries. Until recently, China was taking a lot of this stuff, but a couple of years ago said, no, we're not doing that anymore. So it's now flowing into other countries that are openly burning it. So when you hear the plastics industry say, well, it cuts down on food waste, well, we are then shipping that plastic across oceans that it comes with a tremendous amount of carbon emissions involved, where it's then burned and sent into the atmosphere. It doesn't seem particularly efficient to me. But anyway, coming back to the what we can do with plastics is just don't use them as much as possible. Under no circumstances should you prepare baby formula in plastic, warm baby formula. So when I mentioned earlier that we're finding a lot of microplastics in infant feces, that is probably in large part because when you prepare infant formula in hot formula in a plastic bottle, it breaks apart that plastic. And there was a study, the super alarming study that came out a couple of years ago, that showed that, you know, a baby might be drinking a million particles of plastic a day through this formula if you're preparing it in plastic. So prepare it when you can in glass. Just generally buy more glass, put more things in metal. You had mentioned BPA earlier. There was this big movement to get rid of BPA, which is an endocrine disrupting chemical, very terrible for human health. All well and good, except there have been a couple of studies that found that things labeled BPA free, in fact, have BPA in them, because there's just like, there's basically no regulatory framework here in the United States. The other issue is that as we find these chemicals that are known to be bad for human health, the industry just replaces them with chemicals that are very similar in structure, because you have to make a plastic. It can't just be pure carbon, as nice as that would be, because carbon is carbon. It would just melt into the environment, no problem. But it has all these additional chemicals beyond BPA. We have to be very careful about what we let the industry substitute in as we phase these chemicals out, because it could just be something that is just as toxic, if not more toxic, in the case of BPA. So yes, no food in contact with plastic, if at all possible. But this is where I really struggle, is that we don't have choice here. So you have a hard time going to a supermarket and finding things that are not wrapped in single-use plastic. I have the liberty of having a farmer's market here. I get to take a canvas bag and just put things directly in it. That is very lucky for me. That is not the case for a wide array of Americans who may live in a food desert, where you only have access to a convenience store for food and more things are wrapped in single-use plastic there. So there's this equity side of this as well that is just now coming into view. There's a couple of researchers looking into, are disadvantaged people in contact with more plastic, and therefore are they exposed to more poisons within them? But yes, I like to say don't have food in contact with plastic. It's basically impossible to do right now, which is why we need systemic change. It's super great that individuals use reusable metal bottles. That's fantastic for your health. And in the long term, if we get that sort of support swelling for that, we can phase out more plastic bottles, that sort of thing. But it's going to require this huge movement, because the plastics industry will love nothing more than to keep producing more and more plastic, again, three times as much by 2050, and flooding the planet and our bodies with these little tiny particles.
When the plastics are burned and go up into the atmosphere, is that ash still plastic?
Yes, so it will, it's extra bad. So it will burn and it'll break into smaller pieces and it will go up as ash. But in that ash is it's basically microplastic ash and maybe some larger pieces of plastic, because thing of fires is that that warm air rises and propels all that particulate matter into the atmosphere. But you're also releasing just straight up chemicals when you do that beyond the microplastics. And there have been a number of reports in these developing countries that are openly burning this stuff, of terrible health problems for people living around this stuff, because this plastic was long pitched as benign material. Oh, it's very safe. It makes actually things safer. It makes our food safer.
Like, it's so inert.
It's so inert. And don't even worry about it. It's not going to be an issue. But these people have terrible human health effects because they're breathing burnt plastic. But then that is also sending the material up into the atmosphere, again, propelling it because it's this warm air rising. It's, again, a consequence of the United States and other developed countries shipping the stuff that they can't profitably recycle. I will emphasize profitably, because that's been the issue, is that it's just not profitable to recycle. So we just don't bother. That's a perverse system in the United States of capitalism, which is, we're totally fine profiting by making all this stuff, all this plastic, but totally uninterested in actually taking care of it and keeping it from getting into the environment, because once the plastic industry makes it, it could just wipe its hands and walk away, and then blame us as consumers that we're not recycling enough. So recycling needs to be fixed, but it also cannot be a crutch that we stand on, because at the end of the day, we just need to stop producing so much plastic.
I actually am serious. Like, could we gather the plastic and launch it into space? Like, is that actually an option? Because space is so big, would it hurt anything?
There's a two-fold issue, I think, which is people talking about this with like spent nuclear material. Like, let's just get it off of Earth. Well, if you fire that rocket and it explodes in the atmosphere, you then poison the entire planet with radioactive material. The same could be said for plastic. The bigger issue is it's just so expensive to launch a rocket. And you can't, like, when you think about plastic, it's a very undense material. So there's only so much you can get into plastic or into a rocket. I would love for that to be just fire a bunch of rockets into the sun. It'd be cool to watch. Unfortunately, not feasible.
Okay. I'm just envisioning like some like ever like flowing thing that just keeps it projecting up. Again, I realize that's kind of like trying to throw our problems somewhere else, but space is big.
Because we're thinking of it shows what a crazy problem this is, that we are up against an industry that is going to keep producing more and more plastic. And we know for sure that too much of this stuff is escaping into the environment. We know for sure that there are increasing bodies of evidence showing that this is bad for human health. Because like the very fact that we're sitting here thinking about this shows that this is just a very daunting problem. It's very easy to get dejected about it, but that's also what the plastics industry wants us to feel. It's the same thing with climate change. They want us to feel dejected and hopeless because that's going to keep us from taking action on climate change to reduce our emissions. They want us to feel bad about flying, right? Like, because you flew across the country, you made climate change worse. No, that's a drop in the bucket as far as emissions concerned. It's because we have this economy that is built on burning carbon that is the issue. We need to get away from that. In the same way, we need to stop producing so much plastic. We need to reduce our reliance, because we cannot let the industry, again, make this our fault, because it never was. We never asked for our cucumbers to be wrapped in single-use plastic. At least I didn't, and you probably didn't either. And I think this is where the movement is going to be, is in increasing realization of just how absurd this has become, wrapping vegetables in single-use plastic, that sort of thing. So maybe that's where we see movement, and maybe that's where we see that we start electing politicians that take this seriously and realize that climate change and plastics are two sides to the same coin. It's fossil fuels. It's one and the same. And again, as the industry starts to pivot away from fossil fuels, as we switch to more wind and solar panels, as we switch to more wind and solar power, they're going to put much more investment in plastics. This is their strategy. It's not a secret. It's just not very well publicized, because I don't think a lot of people realize that plastics were fossil fuels. So that's what we're up against. But I do have hope that we can elect people that actually take this seriously and try to wrestle the influence of the fossil fuel industry away from politics, hopefully, ideally. I don't know.
And what's also super interesting and also disheartening. But it was actually, there was one time I laughed when I read your book, but it wasn't a happy laugh. It was an ironic laugh when you talked about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, which if listeners like Google that, is just shocking to look at. But the attempted cleanup effort, which was, great that they were attempting it, but it was such an epic fail. The one that, at least what you talked about in the book with the thing that they built to go, what was it? Like something that was going to go clean it up and then it broke and was made of plastic?
Yeah. So this is the fundamental issue with mitigating the problem. So they sent out this big plastic catcher. It's a giant tube that plastic floats into in the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. You send out a boat to accumulate all that plastic, bring it back on shore, which is like, all right, good luck, even if that works. The first one that they sent out split in half because I think the open ocean is going to have other ideas about trying to engineer a massive plastic tube to produce plastic, which then ironically breaks into plastic pollution itself, and they have to tow it to Hawaii for repairs. This is something that microplastic scientists talk about a lot, which is that is way too far downstream. We need to get way more upstream when it comes to mitigation. So by that, I mean that the farthest upstream we can go is to stop producing so much plastic. Again, I hate to keep harping on it, but that is how we fix this problem. Going farther downstream, what you can actually do in your home is to buy a microplastic filter, microfiber filter for your washing machine. It's an aftermarket thing. You slap it on. I have one. It works pretty well, I think. And that keeps some of the microfibers from your clothing from washing out to a wastewater treatment facility. The issue there is that we need to first somehow dispose of those microfibers in a good way. Like if you throw it in the trash can and the trash is then exposed to open air and those fibers take the air anyway, it didn't do you much good. So that'll be, I think, worked out in the coming years as we also try to put just more of those fiber filters standard into washing machines. France is actually the first to mandate this. By 2025, all washing machines in France have to have these filters. So that's a little farther downstream, still good. Rain gardens, as I mentioned before, are a little bit farther downstream. That is closer to the ocean, but still keeps those particles from getting out there. The other one I mentioned in the book is my favorite technology of all time, Mr. Trash Wheel, which is a barge in Baltimore Harbor. It is a giant barge with giant googly eyes that eats trash floating down the river. It collects all of it into a barge, and then they take that waste and recycle it. That's like at the very last stop before the open ocean to catch that plastic before it gets out there. Again, macroplastic like bottles and bags are just pre-microplastics because they're going to break down once they're out there. So there's up and down this stream that we can move. The farthest downstream you could possibly go is to try to get the stuff out in the open ocean. But farthest upstream we can go is to just not produce the plastic. And then we don't have to worry about it escaping into the environment. So that's when microplastics researchers talk about this, they say, first of all, the plastic catch in the ocean is not going to capture microplastics in any way, but also it's kind of a boondoggle. Like on a wide scale, it's going to be very difficult to make work.
Are you a Star Trek fan by chance?
You know what? I'm going to embarrass myself and say that I have not seen much Star Trek.
Okay, never mind. This reference won't make any sense. There's an episode called The Doomsday Machine where it's this thing that just goes around. For listeners who know Star Trek, that's what I keep thinking of with these things going into the Great Pacific Garbage Patch or this trash wheel. So the microplastic or microfiber filter, is that different than the lint catcher in your washing machine?
It is. And that's the frustrating thing is that other countries actually have microfiber filters just kind of standard in their washing machines to keep that what would become lint in a dryer because they use more line drying. They don't have dryers. So.
Oh, right. Okay. I'm like looping it all together in my head. Never mind.
No, I mean, it's a good question. So we need them on both, right? So that's a weird thing when you think about the next time you dry your clothes and you clean out that lint filter. If, you know, 2/3 of your clothing is made out of plastic, that's concentrated microplastic. And that's actually the stuff that then gets spread onto fields, right? So like that would normally go to wastewater treatment facility. That's the stuff that's coming out of your washing machine. So we need it on bus. We need keep the lint filters for sure, but we need safer ways to actually dispose of it. Because when you're pulling it out of the washing machine, that stuff is taking to your indoor air. when you're pulling out your dryer, that stuff is taken to indoor air, but we need them on washing machines as well. And we need to mandate actually that the manufacturers start putting them on, like France has started to do. Otherwise, we're kind of left to our own devices getting these aftermarket filters, which are not too expensive. You can get one for like $50. But it's, again, it's not our responsibility. I want to keep coming back to this. I don't want to make people feel bad about their contribution to microplastic pollution, because this is a plastic industry problem, not a consumer problem.
Is it something that anybody can outfit their washing machine with? They can order this filter?
Yeah, it should be. There's a couple of companies that do it. My dad is more handy. He installed it for me. It attaches to the hoses that go in and out of the machine. It attaches to the one that goes out of the machine. The water passes through it. And then mine is a removable filter that you actually send back to the company, and they will actually turn that into home insulation. So you're locking it. You're trying to lock away the microplastic for as long as possible to keep it from getting to the environment.
Very cool. Maybe I'll look up some resources and put a link in the show notes to that. So it was so interesting reading about the clothing and the washing and all the things. And it made me do one change that I knew I should have done already, but I read your book and I was like, oh, okay, I can't not do this anymore. I was using the single use, you know, like the pods that you throw into the washing machine. Those are wrapped in some sort of plastic, I think. I mean, it's supposed to degrade or, you know, it breaks down in the water, but that's even worse.
It breaks into microplastics. Like when people say that this plastic is biodegradable, what they're not telling you is that it is still plastic out there. Like it's just deconstructed, right? It's like, it's the same plastic. It's just in millions of parts.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So that change. And then on the one hand, I felt better about my clothing habits because I tend to wear, I have like 4 outfits. They're the exact same thing. And I wear them every single day because of decision fatigue. Like I just want to wear the same thing every day. I don't want to think about what I'm putting on, which I always thought I was really crazy. But then I realized that like, that's what Steve Jobs did and like Barack Obama. So maybe I'm not crazy. So that made me feel better because you were talking about how something that we can do is, you know, buy good clothing and wear it a long time. But then on the other hand, when I'm going out, I like to always wear a new dress. So I probably offset my daily habits that way.
I mean, you're right. You're right, though. I think that's a great strategy. I talk in the book about a number of studies that actually agree on this, that the more you wash a garment, the less microfibers it actually expels. So when the first couple washes, probably a lot of the microfibers from the manufacturing process are just kind of getting jostled loose and wash out in the washing machine wastewater, but over time it actually produces less and less microplastic. And if it's a high quality garment that lasts you for years, and if it's not breaking apart, like if you have something from fast fashion and you notice that it's breaking apart after a month, it's breaking into microplastics that are then flushing out to a wastewater treatment facility. So you're right. It's good to wear the same stuff or whatever. I do the same thing. I'm fine with it. I think we should start a movement. I don't know.
It's funny. I feel embarrassed because there are a few things that I do every single day. Like I go to cryotherapy. I'm like, they probably think I'm so weird that I wear the exact same thing in every single day, but makes my life easier. And so another question about the BPA. I'm fascinated by BPA because especially reading your book, I was already curious or skeptical about this, but then reading your book, I became even more so. You talk about all of these potential compounds and chemicals and plastics. So BPA, why did we focus on BPA? Is it really like the one thing, or is it just so happens that for whatever reason, BPA is what they focused on? And you mentioned this earlier, like the alternatives, like, you know, BPA free might still have like BPF or BPS, and those haven't been studied as much. So is it possible that BPA free is worse than BPA?
It's possible, and it's actually quite a concern among scientists, is that we started in plastics with BPA. That was linked to a number of human health problems, which pressured the industry to start phasing it out. But as you mentioned, we might be phasing in these alternatives because you're still going to need to make a plastic. BPA served a very good purpose, right? So like they need to substitute something in, and we don't really have good data on, okay, well, is that chemical because it's similar structure, just as bad, if not worse, for human health. In the United States, there's just almost no regulation around this sort of stuff. And this is certainly what we need more of. And I think BPA is one of these EDCs, a number of different chemicals that have effects on the endocrine system. And we are now in this situation where we have to start picking through all of these and plastics and doing more studies on what they do for human health. But there are a number already that are linking them to health problems. And the kind of scary thing, the way that EDCs work, is that their dosing doesn't work like a typical poison would. So you think of something like aspirin. If you take enough of it, it's a poison. There's this, if you pull out a graph, there's this line that just goes up and up and up. EDCs work differently, where it's more of like a U shape. So even at very, very low concentrations, you can get a severe effect. And then moving right on the graph, it actually goes down kind of in that middle sort of dosage, but then comes back up again at very high doses. So the concern with microplastics is that maybe even on these very small scales, getting into our lungs and our digestive systems, that the EDCs could have an effect there. But there's just, we're at the very, very beginning of understanding the human health effects of microplastics. Quote a scientist in the book who says that we don't know about 99% of it. We have 1%, and that's a start, but it's going to take much more research to figure out what these different chemicals are doing to human health.
The U-shaped toxicity curve is so even more concerning because, you know, you would like to think that the dose is in the poison, so you require more for it to be toxic, but basically, you know, different exposures might have just as much of an issue, which is crazy. Another question about the biodegradable. So when things are labeled as being biodegradable, so that does not mean it's plastic free, to clarify. That could just mean that it breaks down faster.
Yeah, the terminology here gets tricky. So biodegradable basically means that it's going to break down faster. The issue with biodegradable, so I think a lot of people think about compost bags as biodegradable, and they are to a certain extent. They're still plastic to a certain extent in that they are meant to degrade under a certain set of conditions. And that is in these industrial composting facilities at very high consistent temperatures. Coming back to this idea that heat is one of the things that breaks down plastics. That compost bag is still plastic. And then the issue becomes that that's mixed in a lot of times with the compost and then spread on crops. So we're getting microplastics from compost bags on our crops in addition to the microfibers in sludge from our clothing. That's the problem with composting. The other issue is that if that compost bag is in some other environment that is not an industrial composting facility with consistently high temperatures, it does not break down. There was a good study that actually did this over time, like putting bags in soil and in ocean water and showing that sometimes after years, they would be intact enough to still carry stuff in. The biodegradable is not a regulated term. That is also different from bio-based. So it's a little tricky. So bio-based means you're getting the carbon chains in the plastic from plants, so sugarcane or corn, instead of from fossil fuels. Unfortunately, you still have to have all of those chemicals that make plastic a plastic mixed in with them. You're just getting carbon from a different source. So that's a little bit of a difference between bio-based and biodegradable. It's all messy. It's the wild west of terminology and regulation. Just think of when you're using a plastic, at some point, it's just going to break down into microplastics regardless. Where it does so is an open question because the chain of possession here when it comes to taking care of plastic waste is very unclear.
Hi, friends. I have very exciting news. So I know you guys already know and love Element and understand the importance of electrolytes for hydration, energy, focus, supporting your fasting, your workouts, all the things. Guess what? Element has a product that goes beyond electrolytes. What is it? Well, so I am very pro the benefits of caffeine. I love the cognitive benefits, the longevity benefits. And that said, I am a slow caffeine metabolizer, so I don't actually take in lots of caffeine. I've also learned that the form, dose, and balance of caffeine makes a huge difference in how you actually feel. That's why I am so excited that Element has launched a brand new lemonade iced tea. It's refreshing, delicious, lightly caffeinated, perfect for summer. And what I really love is the science behind it. So instead of relying on massive amounts of isolated synthetic caffeine like so many energy drinks out there do, Element Lemonade Iced Tea uses a full black tea extract. So alongside the caffeine, you naturally get compounds like L-theanine and polyphenols. The L-theanine actually helps smooth out the stimulant effect for a calmer, steadier energy experience with less spikes and crashes, while the polyphenols provide antioxidant support as well. And you guys know I am all about the antioxidants. And the incredible team at Element, including my personal hero, Rob Wolf, conducted a meticulous amount of research to find the perfect amount of caffeine, which is the sweet spot for sustained focus and energy without feeling overstimulated or wrecking your sleep later. That is exactly 50 milligrams of caffeine. On top of that, they knew that caffeine can increase your need for critical minerals like sodium, potassium, and magnesium, so that's why Element Lemonade Iced Tea pairs the perfect amount of caffeine with a meaningful dose of electrolytes to support optimal hydration and performance. And of course, Element Lemonade Iced Tea is completely free of sugar, artificial colors, and all the other stuff that you do not want that are so commonly found in caffeinated drinks today. It's built on the same science-backed electrolyte formula that Element is known for, with sodium, potassium, and magnesium in ratios designed to support hydration and energy production. The result? You get your perfect pack of portable, easy-to-make lemonade iced tea that provides steady, clean energy that tastes delicious and actually feels good. As you guys know, Element is trusted by neuroscientists, functional medicine practitioners, professional athletes, including the NFL, the NBA, the NHL, and they're even used by Navy SEALs and the Marines. So are you ready to up your drink level with the ultimate lemonade iced tea? You can get it. And when you get it, get a free 8-count sample pack of Element's most popular drink mix flavors with any purchase at drinklmnt.com/Melanie Avalon. That's right, a free 8-count sample pack of Element's most popular drink mix flavors with any purchase at drinklmnt.com/Melanie Avalon. Find your favorite flavor or share it with a friend. And by the way, Element has an amazing no questions asked refund policy, so you can try it completely risk-free. If for any reason you're not satisfied, they will give you your money back. Again, go to drinklmnt.com/Melanie Avalon for a free 8-count sample pack of Element's most popular drink mix flavors with any purchase, including their new lemonade iced tea.
Okay, so this is perfect timing. So this week, literally this week, I got approached by a brand to partner with for the show, and I'm vetting them right now. And so I'm looking at their website. I'm not going to say what the brand is because I'm not sure if I'm going to partner with them or not. This is like a good example where I can't tell, like reading the information, if it's great or if it's not great. Can I read you? Can I read you some of what they say and you can let me know what this is saying?
Sure.
So what they make is they make like, it's like compostable bags. So like grocery bags, storage bags, like for food in your freezer, like gallon bags. Yeah. And then mostly, but their main thing is trash bags. So they say we use non-toxic ingredients like PBAT, PLA, and cornstarch to produce our strong and sustainable material. Our plant-based renewables come from the earth and degrade cleanly back into the earth without producing microplastics or toxic residue. And then for the breakdown, they say that, so PBAT is a biodegradable polymer that requires less crude oil during production than plastics and breaks down quickly without emitting methane gas or creating toxic residues. And then they say that PLA is a monomer derived from organic renewable sources like sugar or corn. It requires less energy in production and emits less greenhouse gas and decomposition than plastic. And then they say cornstarch is an organic substance that is ethically harvested from corn and biodegrades quickly without toxic gas. And then they say that they use responsible packaging, minimal recyclable packaging made with 100% FSC, which I don't know what that is, certified material from responsible sources in an effort to reduce waste. So that type of stuff.
It's a lot.
Yeah. You don't have to like comment in detail on everything. But so is that like what you're talking about with the bio-based stuff rather than biodegradable?
If they're using PLA, they're talking about bio-based. So using... they're making their chains of carbon out of plastic instead of fossil fuels. So that's like, I get I get pitched on this sort of thing all the time as a science journalist about these alternatives. And I'm with anything, I'm very curious about the scientific rigor behind any claim, right? So like when you say it's non-toxic, well, non-toxic to what, right? Like if it's a microplastic breaking down in the environment, is it toxic to other things? I mean, I never cover these things because at the end of the day, I harp on, we just need to use less plastic at the end of the day. Alternatives are going to help, but we need to be very careful that we are not producing things that are just as harmful as plastic. These things, I would love to see scientific rigor behind what they're claiming here. But yes, so that is sounding like a bio-based plastic instead of a fossil fuel-based one.
Because I'm wondering, so like, have you heard before of polybutylene adipate terephthalate, PBAT? It has the word phthalate in it.
Yeah, I've heard of terephthalate. I hadn't heard of that other one. So this is actually the kind of fascinating thing about plastics is there are so many different varieties. So from that original synthetic billiard ball, it has diversified into this whole range of different plastics, which has made actually figuring out a lot of things in microplastic science quite difficult because you know, one variety of plastic might break down differently under UV bombardment. A bio-based plastic might break down differently than a fossil fuel-based one. This is the issues that as we are transitioning perhaps away from plastics and looking for alternatives that are non-toxic and are not based on fossil fuels, we need to apply scientific rigor to what all that actually means in practice. So I'm hopeful to a certain degree that there are going to be alternatives coming out in the years to come, but we cannot lose sight of the fact that we just need to use less plastic in general across the board, period. Like at the end of the day, that's it. That's how we fix this problem.
So yeah, because I'm just thinking about this even more and more. Like I would look more into this PBAT because they say it's an alternative to plastics, which makes it sound like it's not a plastic. But like, so this is something where, because you're talking about just reducing our use of this in general, but something like trash bags, like we all need trash bags. So I guess we need something that is a non-plastic trash bag, right? Like, or is there another alternative that doesn't even require that?
Yeah, I mean, trash bags are quite useful, but not necessarily always necessary. I think recycling is probably easier. Like you don't need to necessarily put all your recycling in a plastic bag before you put it on the curb because it's not really dirty. There's not like food stuffs on it if you wash it, that sort of thing. It's just, I think, being more mindful, really, to begin with. So thinking about, you know, all the ways that we are using plastics in our daily lives, which was never our intention. I want to come back to this. We never asked for this much plastic, but little by little, picking out things that we know that we can reduce our reliance on plastic with. Switching to glass and metal, which is reusable, as long as you don't break your glass, reusable over and over again, and, you know, is not as problematic as plastics are. So yes, new materials are going to be, I think, good going forward. But really, to start with, right now, at this very moment, we can all take an inventory in our daily lives of ways that we can cut out plastics entirely.
I launched a supplement line and I did it in glass bottles, which is really rare in the supplement industry. Like most of them are in plastic bottles. But I read your book and I was like, I called my business partner and I was like, we have to change the cap because it still has a plastic cap. I was like, we got to find an alternative here. I'm part of the problem. So in your daily life, what are some of the main things that you do daily to, you know, address this? To use trash bags?
For trash, I try to use as best as you can try, like paper bags as best, but it's like, this is why I think there will be uses going forward for different formulations of things that act like plastics that are waterproof and are just convenient in that way. Cause and I talk about this in the book, that plastic is a wonder material. It has been so extremely useful in a broad range of uses. Like, I'm not sitting here arguing that we should not use plastic in like medical devices, that sort of thing. They will serve a purpose for certain things going forward. But just like taking a look around us and realizing that there are ways to cut out plastics. I have the privilege of going to a farmer's market where I can just put things in a canvas bag. I do the same thing when I have to go to the grocery store, but just avoiding plastic is essentially impossible. Like, it's hard to get out of that place without buying at least one thing that is in plastic. So we need alternatives. We need choice as consumers. Like, that's, I was under the understanding that capitalism was all about choice. In fact, too much choice. And we don't need 20 kinds of toothpaste at the drugstore. That I think a couple will do just fine. But when it comes to plastics, we have no choice. There are not really alternatives, except like niche products. There's a couple of, I've seen for toothpaste, it's like a chewable thing that isn't wrapped in single-use plastic. I'm big on refillable centers. So buying shampoo in bulk, like you have your own glass jar, you go to a local store. There's a couple here in the Bay Area. But that's a privilege. Again, and I want to come back to this equity aspect, that a lot of people do not have the privilege of avoiding plastic. If you live in a food desert, you only have access to stuff that is wrapped in single-use plastic. You have zero choice about your exposure to plastic. I live in a very privileged position where I get to go to a farmer's market every Sunday. So if capitalism is all it's cracked up to be, where's the choice here, right? Where, as consumers, why can't we choose not to use so much plastic day after day?
One sort of like esoteric question to possibly end on, could it have been any other way? Like, if we could go back and know what we know now, what would that have looked like? Like, we would have just produced plastic for, you know, the necessary things and started with alternatives from the beginning. I'm just wondering if it could have been any other way for like the progress of humanity. You talk about like the progress trap.
I mean, yeah. So I keep thinking about, I'm 38 and I grew up in the 80s. And I remember a time where we just had much less single-use plastic. Stuff wasn't wrapped in plastic as much as it is today. It was not that long ago in human history where we had access to plenty of plastics that we got along just fine without them infiltrating every aspect of our daily lives. Again, I'm not saying that we should not use them for very useful things like airplanes. You know, interiors of airplanes would not be able to fly if they weren't made out of plastic. I'm not saying get rid of that. I'm saying that it could have been that after World War II, as we started producing more and more plastics, we could have been much smarter about the uses. Had we known about the awful effects that plastics would be having as production grew more and more out of control. So that's both the contamination in the environment of macroplastic and microplastics. And now, as we're seeing, human exposure to microplastics. There's one researcher I talked to in the book that reckons that we inhale 7,000 microplastics a day. When plastics were first being produced on a wide scale in the 40s and 50s, I don't think anybody thought that that was going to be an issue. We didn't think that was an issue until very recently in human and scientific history. And I think we have, as you mentioned in the book, we have this opportunity to tear ourselves free from this plastic trap. It seems that we are stuck with this material because it is absolutely everywhere. But we can also look back in very recent human history where we had this material, but didn't have it in so many places and in so many ridiculous forms. Single-use plastic is an insane concept. And companies did it because it was profitable. This was a market-based thing. It made it so it was cheaper to ship soda, right? And instead of in a glass bottle, which is heavier, it's just harder to do that. Plastics was a much cheaper way to do so. This is a product of capitalism, and it's going to take a concerted effort on the part of the people and then politicians to rein in these truly sociopathic corporations that have flooded the planet with this material with no consequence. We just had not held them to account. And it could have gone a very different way where we were thinking decades past that, oh, this is getting a little crazy, a little ridiculous that we're producing so much of this stuff for ridiculous purposes. Maybe let's pump the brakes. We have that opportunity. And in fact, that opportunity is extremely urgent because production is going to triple in the next 30 years. That's the insanity of this, is that you thought it was bad now. Just wait 5 years, 10 years. It's going to be much, much worse unless we actually get together and hold these companies to account.
Well, thank you so much. Is there anything else about all of this that you think is important for listeners to know?
One thing I think that would be interesting to add about kind of the climate implications here is that scientists are just beginning to explore what these particles might do to the environment carbon-wise. So if they're up in the atmosphere in very high concentrations, are they absorbing some of the sun's energy while they're up there? Plastics are often made out of these, you know, dark colors that could more readily absorb the sun's energy in the atmosphere, thus heating the atmosphere. Are they acting as nuclei for clouds? So clouds form around little bits of dust or even bacteria, that sort of thing, that act as nuclei. You get water glomming onto that. Are microplastics doing the same? Are they changing the way that clouds are forming? There is additional research that is showing that microplastics release lots of methane in particular as they break down in the environment. So coming back to this idea, this is carbon. This is carbon from fossil fuels. As it breaks down in the environment, where do you think that carbon goes? It often comes off as a gas that then adds to the burden of carbon in the atmosphere. And that's why this is such a urgent issue, is that we can't let the fossil fuel industry wind down the burning of fossil fuels as we switch to renewables and wind up the production of plastics, which is just carbon in a different form. We're going to see a lot more emissions, both from the production of that plastic as we triple production by 2050, but also what's already out there is off-gassing that carbon into the atmosphere. So that's just an additional climate side of things that I think we'll see more research on going forward.
I like how one thing you pointed out in the book was the question of, you know, why focus on plastics when there's all of the climate change and climate issues, but you know, talk about how they're all like overwhelmingly interconnected. So helping one helps the other, presumably. Well, thank you so much. Like I said, your book had a profound impact. I see the world differently now, like honestly. I literally do.
That's great.
So I can't thank you enough.
I mean, that's not great, but...
Yeah, no, it's insane. What are you working on now? Do you have any other future books?
Oh, man. I'm taking a breather from this. This one took a lot out of me. I don't know what's coming next, but I think just some time off from writing books for the moment. We'll see.
Nice. Well, how can people best follow your work on Wired and social media, all the things?
Yeah, you could just, I don't use Twitter much, even before the recent chaos, but you can find my Wired author page just by Googling my name and Wired. I will be there producing content. But otherwise, if folks have questions, feel free to reach out. I think my email, my Wired email is on my Twitter page. So happy to answer questions.
Well, we will put links to all of that in the show notes. And the last question that I ask every single guest on this show, and it's just because I realize more and more each day how important mindset is. So what is something that you're grateful for?
I'm grateful for, you know, all of these scientists coming together from different fields to look at not only the consequences for ecosystems, but more and more to really not rush in the sense that they're not doing good science, but to do very solid science as quickly as possible to figure out the human health effects of microplastics, because they could be severe and we need to know as soon as possible. So I'm grateful to those people doing that hard work, not necessarily uplifting work, but so it goes.
Well, thank you so much. I am so grateful for the work you are doing, because it was, like I said, so eye-opening and a very interesting and accessible read. And so I think it's going to really help a lot of people have a paradigm shift that I think is really, really needed. So you're doing great things that are having actual effects on the world. So thank you. So yeah, so thank you so much for your time. This was amazing. If you do ever write another book again in the future, love to have you back on. And yeah, thanks so much for all that you're doing.
And thank you very much. I appreciate the interest in the book.
Have a good day. Thanks, Matt. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. For more information, you can check out my book, What When Wine, Lose Weight and Feel Great with Paleo-Style Meals, Intermittent Fasting, and Wine, as well as my blog, melanieavalon.com. Feel free to contact me at podcast@melanieavalon.com. And always remember, you got this.